In the second half, I want to talk a little bit about what I mentioned at the outset, the questions of socialist participation in government, colonialism, immigration, women's suffrage, and militarism and war.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Diet Soap is a Sublation Media podcast. Mike Tabor has edited and prepared a number of books related to the history of revolutionary and working class movements, from collections of documents of the Communist International under Lenin to works by James P. Cannon, Leon Trotsky, Malcolm X, Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, Maurice Bishop, and Nelson Mandela. His new book, Under the Socialist Banner, is a collection of the resolutions of the Second International from 1889 to 1912. Mike, welcome to the Diet Soap podcast.
Great, thanks. It's nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, you've created you're preparing a follow-up book to this book that's going to be published hopefully by Haymarket next year. This one featured resolutions of the Second International's Congresses. This next one will include excerpts from oral debates at these Congresses on five topics of contemporary interest: socialist participation in government, colonialism, immigration, women's suffrage, and militarism and war. Why did you choose those particular topics? And also just more broadly, why do you think that studying the Second International is necessary today?
Well, just to step back on it, I think virtually all socialists today are direct descendants of the Second International of 1889 to 1914. Mm-hmm. But relatively few really know much about it, or for that matter, are particularly interested in studying it. And I know this because this is how I was. When I first came to the socialist movement, I had absolutely no interest in studying the Second International. After all, this was the movement that supported World War I in 1914, betrayed the working class. It opposed a number of revolutionary struggles after 1917. Really up until the present day, for the last century, it's taken a position of, in opposition to the colonial revolution, to struggles against imperialist domination, and so forth. I actually came to the Second International through the Third International. That's the Communist International. Since 1983, I've worked on a project to help publish the works of the Communist International, the Comintern under Lenin, to present this movement in its own words. And often I'd come across references to Second International resolutions or documents, and I would just have to look them up. Under the Socialist Banner, the collection of resolutions, was simply to put together for the first time ever in English all the resolutions of the Second International from 1889 to 1912. Mm-hmm. And I thought this would be a useful service. But as I started to compile the material, there was a certain revelation about the, it just struck me about the revolutionary Marxist nature of many of the resolutions, as well as I began to understand what I've come to call the conflicted legacy, of the International. And this is something that, it's valuable for socialists today for a number of reasons. One is because a lot of the subjects, for example, in the follow-up book that I've prepared on some of these debates, a lot of these are subjects that are still current. The question of war, the question of women's rights, the question of immigration, colonialism and imperialism, socialist tactics and the fight for how to win socialist power. These are subjects that are very much on the, on the subjects of debate and discussion in the movement. And also just to understand what the Second International is. Not that we should be trying to simply recreate this movement, but we need to understand the strengths, the weaknesses, the contradictions. It's part of our legacy. If you can't grasp your own legacy, it's hard to deal with the problems and challenges that we're going to be having in the next number of years.
So I'm going to ask you kind of a simple-minded and newbie kind of question, but how many internationals have there been? There's been the first, the second, the third, the fourth, which was Trotskyism. Has there been a fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth? How many have there been?
Well, the Marx and Engels really helped organize the what's called the First International. It wasn't known that at the time. It was the International Workingmen's Association. It was organized in 1864. Mm-hmm. And, at the time, the working class movement was in a sort of a very early stage in most countries. And there were no, outside of maybe one or two places, there were no real working class parties. There really weren't a lot of mass trade unions either. It was a lot of, all kinds of different organizations, cooperatives and other things. And it was an attempt by Marx and Engels primarily to help begin to pull together this into a world movement. And, it accomplished, quite a bit and left an important legacy, but it given the state of the working class movement at the time, early to mid 1870s, it had sort of run its course.
When did the First International start?
In 1864. Okay. In the middle of the American Civil War, as a matter of fact, the opening meeting in London had an American flag in the background. At that time, the United States and the American, it was in the was the fight against slavery, and it was one of the few republics in the world, and it represented a lot of people as it represented progress in the world. A lot of working people and others identified with it, but it's an interesting chapter.
Just to ask a question about the First International a bit more. So 1864, that's a bit after 1848, the revolutionary struggles in the middle of the 19th century. How did Marx and Engels and the rest of the First International conceive of their struggles as in relationship to that revolutionary struggle that had happened in 1848? Were they taking a step beyond that, or how did they think about their revolutionary politics then?
Well, they still stood on the basic programmatic platform that they had put forward in the Communist Manifesto in 1848. Following the 1848 revolution throughout throughout Europe, there was a sort of a reaction to it, and the movement had to take a step backwards. So when Marx and Engels they saw an opportunity when the First International, when the International Workingmen's Association was founded, to begin to link up with the, you know, with the movement that, and with the platform that they had laid out, and to bring it to a much broader audience. And they work with a number of, especially British trade union unions. They were, it was organized and, you know, there were a number of supporters throughout in France, Switzerland, many other countries in Europe. So it was an opportunity to expand the movement and bring in whole new layers of the working class, which was then in the process of growing and developing throughout throughout Europe and North America in particular.
But just, I'm not a historian, so correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding is like 1848 was a revolution that was put down not only for socialists, but also for, you know, bourgeois revolutionaries, there was the struggle for republicanism and national independence and to break with monarchies and autocracies was defeated in 1848 to a large degree. So I'm just wondering if how linked up the First International was with bourgeois revolutionaries that were still struggling after the defeat of 1848.
You're right about the 1848, the revolutions of 1848, 49. Much of it was directed against the fact that almost all countries in the world, were either monarchies, the feudal remnants were abounded. At the time, during the time, Marx and Engels viewed themselves and viewed the early communist movement as sort of a left wing of the democratic revolution. Mm-hmm. What happened was the 1848 revolution, one of the things that it did, particularly in Britain and in France, in Britain to some extent, was it began to waken the working class movement. And this, a lot of the bourgeois republicans, the people were totally scared off by this and actually retreated from it. They saw this what they viewed as this monster, this working class demanding its rights. And this is not what they wanted to see. They wanted a bourgeois republic where their privileges would be protected and that they would be in charge and not some feudal nobility or monarchy. So they retreated from the movement. So by the time the First International was founded, most of these Republican forces didn't want anything to do with the working class movement.
Okay. Yeah. So, and that informed the self-conception of the First International as well.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So how did it come to be that there was it became necessary to form a Second International? What happened to the First International and its efforts to cause it to be dissolved? And I mean, I kind of know a little bit, it had to do with anarchism, but, I'll let you explain. How did that come to be?
Well, it was actually mainly in 1871 in France. You had the Paris Commune, which, you know, in the context of it took place in the midst of a war between France and Prussia, where Prussia was, you know, had defeated France and was. But anyway, what happened was the working class of Paris basically seized power and held power for several months. It was the first example in history of the working class actually taking political power. This example terrified the ruling powers of really the entire world. you know, for example, when the Paris Commune was defeated, there was a really a bloodbath as the surrendering thousands of Parisian workers were just put against the wall and shot, part of the and there was this massive campaign of hysteria that was waged through the media, through the world media and elsewhere, about these terrible communards who were trying to overthrow civilization and the church and the family and, you know, all the other, all this other stuff. And there was all kinds of things about how the First International was in charge, was behind the whole thing. And so there was an international campaign against the First International. And in that context, the base of the International was not large enough to withstand that. And there were, as you mentioned, the divisions within it with anarchism and, you know, and other currents. And it was there was no alternative but to basically to let it pass. The scene. But then in the, you know, in between the middle 1870s and the late 1880s, there was a massive, you know, a real growth of the working class movement throughout Europe and North America. There was, some massive, you know, parties, unions, and others began to be formed. And there was the opportunity arose to reestablish the International. We call it the Second International, but it actually didn't, it never actually had a formal name. People referred to it as the Second International because sort of as a way of recalling the work of the First International and seeing its continuity with that. And in fact, a lot of the early leaders of the Second International were the same people who had helped lead the First International. So a lot of the resolutions and other things dealt with a lot of the same themes that the First International had dealt.
You write in your book that the Second International at its inception was heterogeneous. How many tendencies were included at the outset within the Second International? How diverse were the perspectives on socialism at the beginning?
Well, I would say in terms of the question of heterogeneity, there's really three levels of heterogeneity. One was in the condition of the various countries. We look at the world today, there's many, you know, commonalities in, between most countries and their economies and many other questions. But at the time, that wasn't the case. You had some developed capitalist countries with with industry growing. You had countries that were overwhelmingly agricultural with little industry. You had some countries with colonial empires, others not, and so forth. You had different types of political conditions in the country, from monarchies to countries with some degree of democratic rights and so forth. You also had, secondly, you had different levels of working class organization. In 1889, when the Second International was founded, there was really only one what you could call mass working class party, which was the Social Democratic Party in Germany. And you had smaller parties in other countries. You had different degrees of trade union organization. And, you know, all throughout Europe, they were growing, but, different degrees. Now, the third thing that I think you're referring to specifically on the political diversity in it. There were different wings of the working class movement. There was still the legacy of anarchism, which particularly in Southern Europe was quite strong. And was one of the things that sort of helped contribute to the demise of the First International. But you also had different, in France, for example, there were two main working class parties, one that was the sort of the revolutionary Marxist wing, and you had a second wing, which was a reformist one, which was called the term that was used then was the possibilists. The reason for that was because their goal was to fight for reforms that it considered possible, within capitalist society. So they were the possibilists. You had one of the interesting points that when the Second International was 1889, when it was founded, there were actually two separate congresses. There was the Marxist Congress, and both of them were the same dates and at the same city in Paris. So you had the Revolutionary Marxist Congress, and then you had the Reformist Possibilist Congress also. Mm-hmm. So
what would be considered possible then? Was it a difference between some sort of minimal program and a maximal program, or even some reforms thought to be beyond the bounds of what was possible by the possibilist, or what was the limit there?
Their idea was rather than focusing on the revolutionary Marxist, the Marxist wing, posed the need at certainly you accept and fight for all reforms that benefit the working class and the people in general, but at the same time they understood that the general condition of the working class could only be changed fundamentally by changing the social order, where you replace the rule of the capitalists by the rule of the working class. That was the perspective of going back to the Communist Manifesto, and that was actually that of the First International. But whereas some of the possibilist forces, the reformists, they wanted to focus almost exclusively simply on the fight and not to talk about so much about this other stuff, but mm-hmm. to focus in on simply the more minimal things of what it felt was possible, which is actually sort of self-defeating, because almost every major reform that's ever done has come about through, the fight for more fundamental structural and social change, and then reforms are granted as a way of when it's felt that that's necessary.
I'm reminded of the crisis in Marxism that occurred, I think, a little further down the road from where we're at right now in our history, but it was in the late 19th century. There was a feeling that there was a need to revise Marx's tenets and theories. Bernstein attempted to revise Marx's ideas in the wake of a boom after the Long Depression, I think was part of it. He argued that it was not necessary to actually install a proletariat power, but rather that through the gradual expansion of capitalist forces that socialism would be kind of evolve into place. And there was a debate within the International and Second International, I believe, which he lost. But I've read that it argued that while Bernstein lost the theoretical debate, the practical political decisions of the party or of the International after that were more in line with Bernstein's perspective than with the more revolutionary Kautsky. Is that true? Did the possibilist faction have you know, make a lot of progress in controlling the terms of Second International's debates or setting the horizon in Second International?
Well, it's, you know, even though the there were, you know, possibilist reformist forces with, you know, within the Second International, you know, really, you know, from the beginning. I mean, after, okay, at the, I mean, one thing was Friedrich Engels, Marx's, close collaborator, was very much involved in helping to organize the founding Congress of the Second International and collaborated with the organizers of it and so forth. And he helped make sure that the resolutions of the that were adopted were in line with with the revolutionary perspective that he and Marx had fought for. And it really for the, you know, even though there were these reformist forces in the International, really for the first, close to a decade, the Marxist perspective of the, that at least that were formally in its resolutions were not challenged. And as you say, it was Edward Bernstein who himself had been a collaborator of Marx and Engels and one of the leaders of the German Social Democratic Party. He developed around 1890, after 1897, really up through 1897, 98, 99, what he called it evolutionary socialism that, first of all, capitalism had overcome many of the contradictions that Marx and Engels had pointed to, that it was able to resolve some of them, that it was possible to get sand down its rough edges, make gains, that it wasn't necessary to talk so much about, the final goal, the need for revolution and so forth. And I think how he expressed it was that the movement itself is everything. The final, he's not interested in the final goal, but in the movement. So there was debate, on that. And actually, most of the leaders of the Second International and the German Social Democratic Party participated. Bernstein's views were formally rejected, although, as you point out, there were the degree of support that Bernstein's views had were much greater than the people who voted for him, because they figured it was no reason to you don't say these things, you just do them. That was
right. Yeah. Right.
So that's what they, so you began to have it. And actually they're related to Bernstein, and really at actually the same time, 1899 in France, you had a French socialist named Millerand, who actually became a minister in the French government in 1899. This was the same. That's something that really hadn't happened. The socialists they had proposed that, nobody had supported that, and there was that caused a whole other debate in the International, which is one of the points that the new book will take up. But as sort of a thing that sort of indicate the contradiction of Millerand's position is, okay, he was, he became a minister, but the defense minister in this government that he took on was the general who had largely been responsible for the massacre of the veterans of the Paris Commune in 1871. So he was a fellow minister in Millerand's government. So there was a whole, you know, debate, and really it took up the Second International Congresses of 1900 and 1904 were largely devoted to debating this question. And at the end, it was decided that, it condemned what Millerand did. And at the same time, it also adopted a position that socialists had no business supporting bourgeois political parties either. So that was a related aspect of the debate.
Mm-hmm. And the reason why Millerand felt that he was justified in participating in bourgeois governments and bourgeois parties was because he essentially held the same position as Bernstein, which was that capitalism itself could overcome its contradictions and be transformed into socialism. Or was he just an opportunist through and through?
Well, I think that's the latter is the case, because I don't think he spent much time trying to justify it. And as a matter of fact, he very quickly left working class socialist movement. It just became a run of the mill capitalist politician who was in government for many years afterwards. He totally broke with socialism entirely. Unlike Bernstein, who had maintained, he became what we would consider a run of the mill social democrat till the end of his life. Who called himself a socialist and would justify his position.
Let's talk about that term social democrat for a moment, because the people who call themselves social democrats today are not quite the same as the people who call themselves social democrats in the Second International. I don't believe. There's an old comedy routine about social democracy by the name of the man, he just died. I can't remember his name all of a sudden. I'm getting old too now. But in any case, where if you're a social democrat, you're kind of middle of the road. Sort of neither on the left nor the right, according to this old comedy routine from the 60s. But what did the Second International mean by the term social democracy or social democrat? Why was that the banner under which they organized?
Well, I think that here it's worthwhile to go back to what we were discussing earlier. Throughout the 19th century, the frame of reference for politics, in the whole era of the bourgeois revolutions, was that the most European powers, you had a number of dynasties, monarchies, very few. I think France became a republic in 1848, but then I think they still call themselves a republic. But even under the empire of Napoleon III, and there were a couple of other very few democratic rights were not. In most countries, were not very developed. So the question of democracy became a frame of reference, and you had what we were talking about before, the sort of the bourgeois democracy, what was called liberal democracy. Those whose goal was a system where the propertied classes would run things instead of some semi-feudal nobility or monarchs. So in counterposition to these liberal or bourgeois democrats, the socialists called themselves social democrats. That is, they wanted to extend democracy to the social level. This was the term that that um, that came to be used by, by the Marxist movement, the revolutionary socialist movement. Although it's, to be fair, it's worth pointing out that Marx and Engels they could go along with this term, but that they really didn't like it all that much. I think the term that Engels once used it passed muster. I think that was the term he used. He says that certain social democrats could pass muster, but of course that they actually preferred the term communist, which is, you know, the name of the Communist Manifesto. Social democrat, that was the term used. And it wasn't until 19 when the term itself became totally discredited by the majority of the Second International, the majority leadership, that those left-wing socialists abandoned the term because the term had been so totally disgraced that it had no authority amongst it was felt that it had little authority amongst the conscious workers, you know, at other time.
Right. I remember the name of the comedian, by the way. It was Mort Saul. You ever heard of Mort Saul?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So he used to do a routine on social democrats. So why did the Marxists and Engels prefer the term communist to social democrat or social democracy? Just because they were certainly pro democracy, right? But what did communism communicate that social democracy didn't?
Well, it's not that they thought that the term was wrong or yet. I mean, they supported the fight for democratic rights. And actually, if you read the resolutions of the Second International, that was an essential part of what they fought for was what socialists, they supported the fight for the extension of democratic, the fight for all with democratic rights, whether it's in terms of the electoral political level on the type of political system and extending it to the social level, fighting for reforms, social programs. But again, these weren't fought as ends in themselves, but simply as weapons to advance the struggle even further. The things that the working class needed and by winning these gains, the working class would get experience fighting and get confidence and in its power and its ability to organize, change things, and win allies from other sections of the population, and put themselves in a position to advance further towards the full taking of political power by the working class, by the majority. And as a matter of fact, that was when in the early Russian Revolution of 1917, that was how it was put forward by, that was presented by supporters of the October Revolution and the Bolsheviks, was the majority of the population asserting its power, that this was the most democratic type of system that could be fought for.
I want to read. We're coming up on the end of the first hour here, but I want to read a section from the Second International's initial Congress, the founding Congress in 1889, because I think what I've been doing in this first half is just trying to get a better understanding of how the Second International conceived of its own political mission, to the degree to which that conception was fragmented or divergent within the Second International. So here's a quote I want to ask you a question about. This is that they said, the emancipation of labor and humanity cannot occur without the international action of the proletariat, organized in class-based parties, which seizes political power through the expropriation of the capitalist class and the social appropriation of the means of production. And I guess what I want to ask you is, how did the members of the Second International understand the aim of social appropriation of the means of production? I mean, it's easy enough to understand seizing political power, and maybe that, but through that, seizing property rights for the means of production. But this term social appropriation might seem to point a little bit beyond that. So I'm wondering if you thought that or think that it did.
Well, I think that, you know, what you just quoted, you know, as one of the important points that that was presented in the platform was something that really present, you know, it was from a resolution that had been presented by two of the, you know, the leading Marxists within the Second International, August Bebel in Germany and Jules Guesde in France. You know, it's something that's completely consistent with the, you know, the, what had been outlined by Marx and Engels and their, you know, in their writings and what they had presented. And the social appropriation, the means of production, they, you know, that this is a basic idea that the Marxist movement has, you know, has really had since the beginning, that the, whether it's the manufacturing, the factories, the mills, the transportation network, you know, all the various aspect of it, that the point of it is to use it for the benefit of society as a whole and not private property for a handful of capitalists. So, you know, that's one of the things that sort of marked the, you know, the movement from the beginning. Now, how different people understood it, this is a separate question, because that I really can't speak to, because obviously we know that there were different currents that, you know, developed within, you know, within the movement at the time. But, you know, I think as a good short presentation of what the founding platform of it is. This is one of the things that I think really helps establish, at least on the level of its formally adopted resolutions, the revolutionary Marxist character of the, you know, of the Second International in the quarter of a century before the First World War. But again, as we were talking about, the you know, it's the, you know, at the same time as that you had these formally adopted resolutions, you had the development of different trends, you know, within the international, which is really what the subject of the debates really helped to illustrate in a big way.
I wonder to what degree people within the Second International had read Capital, you know, at least the first volume of Capital. Did that inform their perspective on what it means to overcome the capitalist means of production, do you think?
Well, certainly the majority of people who supported wouldn't have read it. But I think it was a work that was certainly socialist leaders. Actually, one thing here it's worth pointing out, you know, you know, this, it's always viewed as sort of today, it's sort of viewed as something that, you know, very sort of difficult to understand and, you know, but when Marx wrote the first volume of Capital, and it was published in 1867, I believe, mm-hmm. He viewed this as something that workers could and should read. It was written to an extent. It was actually even written for, at least on one level, for working people. So I think that that did certainly informed a lot, a lot of the leaders, and I think that certainly a lot of the leaders were, and the ranks were familiar with it. It was promoted at different levels, but in some, certainly in different parties and in different ways. But I think it did. It was one of the foundation stones of, of the movement.
I just wonder to what extent the Second International thought that nationalization or the ownership of the means of production by the state was synonymous with socialism. And that's the reason why I brought up Capital, because if you read Capital, you can see that it's not as simple as taking up the wealth and distributing it equitably, right? Because of the way that the production itself informs the kind of distribution you're going to be able to achieve. I just wonder to what extent did the Second International see its task as not just like empowering the working class, but overcoming class or abolishing self-abolition of the working class.
One interesting thing, they weren't, I haven't come across any big debates on the question of like socialization, in comparison to nationalization and so forth in the prior to the First World War. But as a sort of an interesting, in the years right after the First World War, the question of socialization actually became a, and socialization / nationalization became a real discussion. And it was really put forward by a number of sort of, within the Second International, there were sort of three trends that developed. We've been talking about the left wing and the right, and the right wing. But there was also a sort of a center wing that developed in the years before, the First World War, that became associated with people like Kautsky and others, and for example, the Austrian party, Hilferding, and. Mm-hmm. So forth, and especially these centrists, they began to really present the perspective of socialization, counterposing this to really what the Bolsheviks did, and so they came up with actually a number of schemes of socialization schemes, and what it really came down to was workers and management sharing responsibility, co-responsibility. In other words, sort of collaboration between the workers and the bosses. And so you had a lot of these schemes where you had the trade unions were one thing, the management is another, and then the third part, which supposedly the neutral arbiter was the government. And of course, what we generally know is the governments always take, since the governments are basically are controlled by the capitalist class, that's whose interests they represent. So it was one of these things that again highlighted the question that we were discussing earlier of reform versus revolution as counterposed strategic objectives within the Second International as it developed.
Yeah. Okay. We've reached the end of the first half for sure. So, in the second half, I want to kind of go through maybe a bit more of the specifics of the Second International's different congresses and the questions that were brought up, and also talk a little bit about the what I mentioned at the outset, the questions of socialist participation in government, colonialism, immigration, women's suffrage, and militarism and war. If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.